From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we find out what's at issue in the fight between Hollywood screenwriters and their talent agents over a new contract.
Agents can be our best friends in the business. They need to be unconflicted friends.
Then Lucas Daunt's film Girl tells the true story of a trans ballet dancer. He shares why casting the lead role took more than a year and a half.
It demands a level of maturity at the age of 15. It demands the physicality of the dance, which as a Belgian small budget production is not very easy to fake.
All that coming up on The Frame.
Podcasts are supported by Cohen Media Group, presenting the film Ash is Purest White. A loving girlfriend defends her gangster boyfriend in an act that sends her to prison. While she's in jail, her boyfriend moves on. Starts Friday at Limley Monica and Arclight Hollywood.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll start today with this.
I promise you, Dominic, it's going to be okay. Put the gun down.
Listen, I wrote it. The plan, I wrote it!
That's a clip from the CBS series Cold Case, which ran for 7 seasons starting in 2003. It was created by writer-producer Meredith Steam, who is also the showrunner. Now Steam cites Cold Case as example A in a dispute going on between the Writers Guild of America and the talent agencies who represent its members. At issue are a few things, but the Cold Case story illustrates how talent agencies, often unbeknownst to their writer clients, take a big cut out of the show's budget and profits as a so-called packaging fee. Those packaging deals have brought talent agencies hundreds of millions of dollars over the years, and the WGA and the ATA are now fighting over whether those fees should be banned. First up to talk about it is Chris Kaiser. He's the former president of the WGA, and he co-chairs the committee that is negotiating with the ATA. He says that packaging fees originally compensated agents for performing actual production duties in collaboration with their writer clients, but that's not how it works out today.
Over the course of decades, that idea that packaging fees would be associated with extra work, a kind of producing work, that's gone away. Nowadays, it is essentially a de facto element of the business that agencies get a packaging fee regardless of what they've done on a television show. About 98% of television shows are packaged. So it is no longer tied to extraordinary work. It is simply the way they get paid. But here's the more important thing. The philosophy of all of this is that agents are motivated to maximize our profits because that maximizes their profits. In a world in which they don't need to worry about whether our salaries go up or down because they're doing fine, that motivation gets diluted a lot. So in the last decade, for example, where the business has doubled in profitability, about $53 billion a year, writer salaries have gone down in double digits, about 16% in the last few years alone. Well, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in a world in which budgets are skyrocketing that writers alone should see their salaries decline.
The other problem I think the Guild has had with packaging fees is that an agency that has a packaging fee on a series may steer its client to that series when there might be better jobs in other places.
The agencies put up barriers between us because they want to protect their packaging fees. So if I were producing a show and I were represented at Agency A and I said, introduce me to different directors, I want to do this with different directors, instead of just saying, you can meet every great director out there, I'm likely to be sent only to the directors from my own agency, because if they send me to a director from a different agency, they end up having to split their packaging fees. And so there's a lot of evidence of deals being held up by agencies who first and foremost are trying to protect their packaging fees. I think we should have open borders here. We should all be allowed to work with each other. I belong to an agency. I love my agent. It's not like a sports team I grew up with. I don't have loyalty in that way. I want to work with the very best people, and I don't care where they're represented. But the agencies care, and that's a problem because they work for me.
And that's not the only point of contention right now. The Guild is also concerned that a lot of the bigger agencies right now, I think especially William Morris Endeavor, have become producers. So they're creating content at the same time that they might be negotiating talent deals for clients in that content. Why is that a problem, and what kinds of conflicts does it set up?
If my agent is also my studio, every dollar I make is a dollar that studio has to pay. I mean, on its surface, it's impossible for me to maximize what I make and for them to maximize what they make at the same time.
If the talent agencies were to walk away from packaging fees, they would be giving up hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars over maybe a calendar year, over a couple of years. What would their incentive be to walk away from that?
There are still hundreds of millions of dollars to be made in the 10% business. It's the 10% business that made the version of CAA that was well-known in William Morris back in the day very powerful and very wealthy. So there's a lot to be gained by representing writers in a $50 billion business. None of us are guaranteed lifestyle. And those agencies that exist in large palaces and we walk into their buildings and we get our checks signed by them as if we work for them, they don't want to give up a single penny of what they make off of their packaging fees.
You're not talking about a contract. You're talking about a balance of power issue. As you just said, that it feels like when you go into, you know, CAA or WME, you're going in as if you work for them other than the other way around.
Right. It's an illusion that they've created, and it works for them very well. But the truth is, and what writers are re-remembering as we have these conversations, is in fact, all of this comes out of the value of what we make. That our value is inherent in ourselves and not related necessarily to whether we're represented by one agent or another. By the way, this is not to say that agents are important. I have an agent. I've had two agents over the last 30 years. I love them both. They've done a great job for me. Agents can be our best friends in the business. They need to be unconflicted friends, and we do not work for them. We just have to remember that over and over again. But you're right. In the end, negotiations are always a question of power. And what we're engaged in right now in the Writers Guild is an attempt to coalesce our power in a way that means that we can take on the fear somehow that the illusion that the agents are the more powerful of the two of us is in fact false.
So your contract expires in less than a month. What could happen in the next couple of weeks?
We're taking a vote at the end of the month, and we're asking the members of the Writers Guild West and East if they approve of us imposing a code of conduct on the agencies should the negotiations fail. So if we cannot reach a deal, we have the right to unilaterally impose those standards on the agencies. That's not actually a negotiation. Which would mean that we could say, here are the new rules, and if an agency refuses to sign that code of conduct, our members could not be represented by them. That is a working rule.
Chris Kaiser is the former president of the Writers Guild of America. He is the co-chair of the union's negotiating committee with talent agents. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John.
So now we know what the writers want. Coming up, we find how the talent agencies propose resolving the dispute with their writer clients. We're talking today about a battle going on in Hollywood between screenwriters and their talent agencies.
I don't steal other people's motherfucking clients. But in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I'm going to take everyone. Your B-level sitcom stars, your reality TV writers. When I'm done with you, you're going to be repping Sideshow Freaks.
Characters like Entourage's Ari Gold created an image of the talent agent as a ruthless pursuer of money and defender of their clients' interests, and that their main rivals are probably other talent agencies. But there's one place where talent agencies are working together, and that's in a contract dispute with the Writers Guild of America. The screenwriters, whose median salaries are falling, want their talent agencies to stop charging packaging fees, which they say have been largely hidden, yet drain money from the shows that the agency clients are making. The WGA also has an issue with agencies that have started creating and financing content through affiliated companies. The writers argue that the agents who are both the employers of writers and represent writers create a serious conflict of interest. Karen Stewart is the executive director of the Association of Talent Agencies, and I asked her to explain the role of a talent agent in 2019.
The writer's in the driver's seat. This I want to make clear. But they need a strong agent in the passenger seat. Because what you have seen and what we know is happening today and over the next 5 years are because of the vertical integrated companies, the fact that you work for a company, it ends up in their silo, it never comes out, it's got no place to sell, there's no transparency in that silo. These are all concerns for the agent, and their artists are asking them to be strong and to render even more services than they do today.
I want to start with something that I suspect both you and the Writers Guild would agree on, and that is that writers are making less money now than they used to. You have a different theory as to why they're making less money. What do you think's behind that economic loss?
Well, we know that the Writers Guild issued its own report saying that its members had record earnings. I think it was $1 billion in TV and $400 million in features. I think those are the right numbers. So we know overall that there are more shows. There are more opportunities, but we also know that because of streaming and consolidation and fewer episodes being made, that the lower to mid-level folks are feeling left behind.
Yeah, they would argue that their median income has gone down, that while the pot is bigger, as you said, there are more shows, so there are more people working. But if you look at an individual writer, his or her income is actually going down.
I think that's correct. Imagine there used to be 22 episode orders, 13 episode orders. In the area, the new areas, specifically streaming and OTT, we're not seeing orders that resemble at all broadcast television, even cable television. So imagine fewer episodes, but you have an exclusivity agreement with your employer. You're tied up. You can't do other work. Of course, that's going to result in mid-level writers getting less money.
I want to ask you about a couple of issues that seem to be central to the negotiations right now. And one is the so-called packaging fee, where a talent agency takes a fee off of the budget of a show and maybe some of its income. What is the historical justification for the packaging fee? Why are they important to agencies?
Well, we've had a lot of meetings, both ATA with our members and our talent agents with their clients, their writer clients specifically. And what we've heard is they want more transparency. And we believe yesterday was the first step in our statement of choice to make sure that we're addressing the concerns that the client spoke to their agents about. And in that transparency and choice, the information will be made available to the writer client, exactly what the agency is doing. We believe, based on what our members have heard from their clients, loud and clear, is they want us to make a new agreement and they want to have choice and transparency.
Why weren't those fees transparent before? Why haven't the agents been sharing that information?
I believe that the agents have not heard what they're hearing from their clients today. They didn't hear this before, but now that we have spent literally months, hundreds of hours listening to the writer clients, we understand what the concerns are, and we believe our proposals yesterday are the path to a new deal.
One of the things that the Writers Guild has suggested is what they're calling kind of an open borders idea, that writers can work with directors and actors at other agencies. They don't all have to be under the same roof when they're put together on a project. Is it your position that writers are pretty much free to go wherever they want and that they're not steered into any one specific place with specific clients from a specific agency?
I believe that is the writer's choice. I believe it's their choice today, and it should always be their choice.
Karen Stewart is the executive director of the Association of Talent Agents. Karen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
A pleasure. Thank you.
The negotiations between the ATA and the WGA will continue, and we will be watching. Now, when Belgian filmmaker Lucas Daunt read an article by Nora Monsecure in 2008, he knew that he wanted to make a movie about her. His new movie, Girl, is that film. In the article, Monsecure, a professional dancer and transgender woman, described transitioning as a 15-year-old and the impact that it had on her classical dance career. Daunt tells her story through Laura, played by Victor Polster. Laura navigates puberty, social anxiety, and the conservative atmosphere of a ballet school, all while beginning the process of a surgical transition. Meanwhile, her father, played by Arie Warthalter, struggles between supporting his daughter's decision and his own concerns over the operation's physical toll. I spoke with director Lucas Daunt recently, and we started with his introduction to Nora Monsecure.
The first time I heard about Nora's story, I was 18 years old, just finishing high school and starting film school. And I read an article in a Belgian newspaper about Nora, a 15-year-old trans girl that wanted to become a classical dancer, but whose school did not allow her to change classes from the boys' class to the girls' class. And on a filmmaker perspective, what really interested me was the combination of the world of the classical dance, which is to date still very binary, divided into roles for men and roles for women. And I saw in that a great metaphor for a bigger picture, for a society that thinks that way. And then this young character that challenges that idea, challenges the norm. And I saw a great message in that.
How closely did you work with Nora about her story and about the things that you wanted to change that were important to your fictional film that were still truthful?
Well, the thing is that my first impulse when I read the story was to make a documentary with Nora. And actually, she was not comfortable being in front of a camera at that moment in her life. But we kept on talking and we kept on being in contact. And what she did agree with was to write something fictional, very inspired by what she went through, but at the same time with a certain distance, so that she could use the writing process also as a way to digest certain things that had happened.
I want to ask you about this idea of binary dancing, because there's certainly in the canon of classical ballet, we think about Balanchine or anybody who is well known, the ballet is the women and the men, and it's neither the twain shall meet. And then there's more modern choreographers like Matthew Bourne and his Swan Lake, or Benjamin Pierre at LA Dance Project, who are challenging those notions.
Yeah.
When you were thinking about the choreography that you wanted to present in this film, it feels very old school. Why is that important?
Well, it was important to me because, although you have some choreographers that really challenge that, classical dance still is, for me, the world that is, when we think of it, is very showing fairy tales, is really dividing into roles for men and women. I was so lucky to meet someone like Chase Chauncey, which is a gender fluid dancer that is really, for me, representing a new voice in the world of the classical dance also. And when talking to him, I was really confronted with the fact that it is still a very binary world. People like Matthew Bourne do change things up by really doing a male Swan Lake and all these things, which I find very exciting.
One of the things that your film does, which is really notable and interesting, is there's no conversation between Laura and her father. She's raised by a single dad. About the decision. The decision has been made. The ship has sailed. That is not something you're interested in about her transition. Mm-hmm. Why was that so important to make that choice?
For me, it was important that we started the film at the moment where the questions are over, at the moment where we are not going into the questionment of does she want it or does she not want it? Lara is a girl, and we follow her on that road. I think in that way, we also really get to focus on the character itself. When I met Nora and when I met her father is such an example of unconditional love and someone that really supports his child and is there for her and doesn't question her identity.
Je suis une fille.
Ben oui, mais t'es une fille. Je vois une fille.
And I really wanted in this film also to have a father-daughter relationship that represents that. And I think if we would have started the film in the moment where they're still deciding or still looking for what they will do, we focus much more on the questions.
Coming up on The Frame, the film Girl has faced criticism from the LGBTQ community. Director Lucas Daunt offers his defense.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Cohen Media Group, presenting the new film Ash is Purest White, official selection Cannes Film Festival. A loving girlfriend defends her gangster boyfriend in an act that sends her to prison. While she's in jail, her boyfriend moves on without her. Starts Friday at the Limley, Monica, and ArcLight Hollywood.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now let's get back to my conversation with Belgian director Lucas Daunt. His film Girl was inspired by the story of trans ballet dancer Nora Monsecure. Girl has received critical praise for its portrayal of the internal and familial strife involved in gender transitioning, but it's also received criticism, specifically regarding its decision to cast Victor Polster as the protagonist, Laura. Polster is not trans, which the LGBTQ community and some critics have deemed dangerous. We pick up my discussion with Daunt with how he cast the film, followed by his response to the criticism.
I would say that the casting for this film was the most challenging part of the production, because for the longest time when I imagined the film, I always imagined the film with Nora. And we cast it for a year and a half. I think we saw 500 young people. And the thing is that this role demands a lot of different things. It demands a level of maturity at the age of 15. It demands the physicality of the dance, which, I mean, as a Belgian small budget production, is not very easy to fake, and a representation of this young trans person. And I think when we met Victor, we all immediately, it's maybe a little bit of cliche, but we all immediately fell in love. You could feel that he had been training from a very young age to become a classical dancer, which is very similar to who Nora is. And he had a certain aura around him that I can't put into words, but I just immediately felt that this was the person that could put Nora on screen and do it in a very elegant and very respectful way.
This film has been judged and probably prejudged by a lot of people, including members of the LGBTQ community. Why was it important in your mind to cast Victor in particular and not a transgender dancer in this role?
It was not important to me to cast a cisgender male. It was important for me to cast someone that I felt that could put Laura to screen in the best possible way. When we organized the casting, we wanted to have an as open casting as possible. We saw young trans people. We saw as much as we could. And at that moment in time in Belgium, in the context that we were making this film, we didn't find a young trans person for this part. I've engaged in a lot of conversation with trans people concerning the film. A lot of people love the film, but there's also a part of the trans community that doesn't. And I think for them, it's also that a lot of trans people are waiting for the stories where we see trans people just in other narratives than the transition narrative, which I completely understand. But this is Nora's story. This is Nora's version. And I really wanted to tell Nora's story because I really thought that there was a very interesting message in what she was going through. And so that's why we made Girl. It's important for me to stress on the fact and repeat it, that for me, this is one story. I am excited about seeing a spectrum of trans stories.
We're talking with filmmaker Lucas Daunt about his film Girl. As part of the story, Laura is struggling with her dancing, and that is in part because in her youth, she was trained as a boy and wasn't dancing on point. Yeah. How hard is it for a talented dancer like Victor Polster to dance badly?
It was the biggest conflict between me and Victor on sets. Usually he listened very well when I asked him something. But when I asked him to dance or make a mistake in the dance, he would not do it. Because what was very important to him is when people would watch the film, that they would think, wow, what an amazing dancer. He's training since he's very young to become a classical dancer. So his image when it comes to dance is very important to him. So that was very tricky because we needed sometimes to see mistakes. We needed to see this character fail sometimes as well.
Stand hip and go.
Victor had been training for 3 months before the shoot to dance on point shoes. And actually there, the reality of this character trying to dance on point shoes and Victor, who was doing the same thing, they sort of collided.
The film requires you to put actors, many of whom are young, into emotionally and physically vulnerable places. So how do you work with your actors and your crew to make sure that there is safety?
During the 3 months before the shoot, we did a lot of things together. Victor, me, Adier, who plays the dad, we did a lot of things like a family. And I think Victor felt very confident with us. And he also felt that I would always be very honest. All the films that I've done up until now, they're very small crew. And I really like this idea of functioning as a small family. Technical-wise, we really wanted to shoot it like we were shooting real life, like a documentary. So those were all important things for me because Victor had never acted before and I wanted him to feel as comfortable as he could.
So this film was inspired by the life of Nora Mansakor, and it is your way of honoring her life. What was it like to show the film to her for the first time?
I mean, that was one of the biggest stresses I've had in my professional life. It's been in my head since 2009. And of course, this film is an homage to her and wants to show a part of her life, show something that she went through. So if she wouldn't have liked the film, if she would have felt like the film was not succeed, that would have been a very, I don't know, that would have been a very difficult thing. So I was really stressed when I first showed her the film. But I mean, it was a very emotional experience. She's very, very proud of the film. She's very proud of herself, and I'm very proud of her. And I think in a way, I got to know her when she was 15 and she's 23 now. And I saw her grow up in every way. Like I grew up with this film. This film is always going to be a part of me because it was with me from my 18 to my 26, which are years that you really change in. And that's also for her the case. And so I think we both really grew up with this film and fully came to terms with ourselves.
Lucas, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Girl is on Netflix starting March 15th. And that is The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.